So yesterday, we are very accomplished because we managed to write down, we wrote down all Lorentz covariant. It is a transform properly. Fermion bilinear, that will enable us to write down any fermion interaction you want, because all the fermion interactions, you have to take a bilinear and put it together with something else. And we even classify them with parity, and we answer the interesting question is that if we know our world is not conserved with parity, is violating this, also known as mirror symmetry, what kind of interaction terms can we write down? And the fact that we studied extensively with Weil spinner is the reason is exactly because our world is not parity conserved. In other words, it's not chiral. So we should have studied the left-handed Weil spinner and the right-handed Weil spinner differently, because some of them couple to the weak force. The right-handed convention is the left-handed coupled to weak force and the right-handed doesn't. So that's all good. And today, yes, I promised that today we're going to quantize Dirac field. After 3 days, we should be very excited. We did so much preparation, and we are calling the course quantum field theory, and we haven't quantized anything yet. But we'll hold on to that a little bit. We'll try to do that hopefully in 15 minutes, because we can continue this discussion, which we did a little bit yesterday, is consider the global symmetry that we have considered before, which is nothing, but it's rotated by a face. Why would a rotating by a face change anything? It doesn't. And then there is the most powerful theorem ever, says that if that's the case, we must have something conserved, and you can write down a inertial current, and you can calculate this. We did that. It looks like this. And then what we also did is try to calculate the charge, and we call this thing fermion number, which is the first component and integrated over space. Okay, so today what we're gonna do is actually use this. We have all these possibilities to write down a Lagrangian term for fermion now that we have all the bilinears. So why should we stay with the free theory? We can now talk about interactions, because we know how to write down a thing called the interaction Lagrangian, starting from the bilinears. As you might notice, this Noether current is a bilinear. Not surprising, Noether current had a better be Lorentz vector. Okay, so the idea is, this is our starting point. We have this very nice vector, and we want to couple to some other vector. And what's the vector field that you have heard about? Like from?
It's like gauge potential.
Yeah, the gauge potential, and normally, yeah, gauge potential is a very, very formal term, normally known as the electromagnetic, whatever the A thing. And they were like, great. I have a vector, I docked it to another vector, I wrote down a Lorentz invariant Lagrangian term. But it turned out this is not sufficient. This is a very good Lagrangian term, but it's actually not independent of our Dirac field. Because whenever we talk about the gauge potential A mu, we almost immediately talk about the property of A mu. So A mu changed by something, something, but then the physics doesn't change. And what is it? The gauge transformation. We have to remember, if we want to call this thing a gauge potential of E and M, if we want to consider this to be the Maxwell A mu, we have to say that this gauge transformation, it should respect the gauge symmetry. That's a symmetry of Maxwell, and if we couple it with somebody else, we should still keep the gauge symmetry. Otherwise, your A mu is something else. So, I hope it's not hard to show that if I do this transformation, my interaction Lagrangian will pick up an extra term. The extra term is this term. Oh, because A mu pick up an extra term. So then the interaction Lagrangian will also pick up an extra term under this gauge symmetry. Well, that's no good. If you pick up an extra term, then it's called the Lagrangian is no longer invariant. So we need to fix this problem. How do we fix this problem? Let's look at our other piece of Lagrangian, which is the established beautiful Dirac Lagrangian that I think I at least read 10 times now. Let's stare at this. How can we fix this term? This extra term, we don't want this extra term. So hopefully we can do something to this Lagrangian that there is something look exactly like that, but in opposite term. X plus minus X equals zero. That's the game we play. And see, this partial mu seems to give us some idea that maybe the kinetic term could be the reason.
Right, down del mu is del mu minus A mu by A mu.
Yeah. Okay, you directly jump to the conclusion. Very good. We'll get there hopefully in 5 minutes. That is the conclusion. And what the standard procedure is called a gauge, the global symmetry. This term is basically local, the alpha parameter. Remember we have this alpha parameter which is arbitrary phase. What we want to do is make it local. Global means alpha is the same everywhere. Local means no alpha depends on space-time. So the claim is that we're going to upgrade or downgrade, depending on who you ask. This symmetry says it's exactly the same symmetry, except I want alpha depends on x. Some sort of promotion says now we wish this is a symmetry. Yeah?
But we already made local the alpha parameter when we consider the change in A mu. Because if alpha is a constant, then A mu doesn't change, and we have no problem.
Right. What you pointed out is correct. Is that okay? I have been emitting some dependence, and now it's causing me a problem. So at this point, when we call it a global symmetry, this thing is a constant. And what you pointed out is, of course, when alpha is constant, this term disappears. So when alpha is constant, it's automatically a gauge symmetry of the F mu nu. But now we're going to ask the question back. It says, if now this alpha in the transformation of the fermion field is also a function of a space-time, can this remain to be a symmetry? So now we want to promote everything to be dependent on space-time. You're right. When this thing is a constant, of course it's a symmetry of a mu. It doesn't even change anything. But the gauge symmetry says when alpha is not a constant, it's a function dependent on space-time, this is a symmetry of the Maxwell theory. And now we want to promote this symmetry says when we do a phase change, when the phase actually depends on the space-time, can this symmetry still, can this transformation still be a symmetry of Dirac? Yeah, we take a minute, think about it.
We explain the global and local argument again, please.
So we know when we change.
What do you say about the del mu being global symmetry, but then
We know it's a fact. If you change the Dirac field by a phase, this Lagrangian does not change. Yeah. But now we're just wondering if we make that a phase, space-time dependent, could this still be a symmetry of Dirac Lagrangian? It's just a question. So yeah, let's postpone the fact that we actually want to fix that. Now we're just wondering a simple question. So there are two lines of argument. The line now we're following is we know when Psi changed by a phase, it is a symmetry of a Dirac Lagrangian. Now we're just wondering, what if alpha depends on the space-time x? Could this still be a symmetry of the Dirac Lagrangian? It's a simple task of trying to hunt down all the symmetries. Okay, we're happy with that? And I'll just add a Q here. This Q is just something that depends on the field. If it's, I don't know, a quark or electron, maybe this Q will change. It's just that Q depends on the intrinsic property of the Dirac field, which type of particle it is. Okay, so now I wonder, is it still a symmetry? Well, let's see. The mass term doesn't really care. The mass term says Psi pick up a phase, Psi bar pick up the phase inverse, so the phase, they cancel. The only thing we need to look at is the kinetic term. Kinetic term, what happens to the kinetic term? Why is it different from the mass term? Because there is a derivative. So I will isolate just the derivative part and figure out what happens to this. And I will only look at when the derivative acting on this phase. So if I'm acting on the phase, it will bring down a minus IQ. It gives me Q partial mu alpha x. And then, of course, all this exponential follows and the psi follows. And then there is the term, then there is the something times partial mu acting on psi. Oh, right. So the other term is the phase doesn't change with the I partial mu acting opposite. Okay. So now let's put back the Psi bar and the gamma mu and the stuff. We realize this, when the partial derivative not acting on the new changing phase, that term gives us back whatever the kinetic term is. It's this is the new term. So now we pick up a new term for the kinetic term, which includes partial bar, gamma mu, and whatever this thing is. And then the phases cancel. So I picked up this. So the question we ask, is it possible this phase symmetry can be promoted to alpha to be a function of x, and somehow the fermion transform in this way will remain the symmetry of our Lagrange? The answer is no, because the kinetic term has this partial mu, and the partial mu will be acting on our new space-time dependent phase, and in the end we can pick up a term because of this. Yeah.
But this term is exactly the term that we get when we perform the gauge symmetry in the AMU, right?
Yeah.
Hooray! Everything is solved.
Now, I can just add those terms provided multiply this term by minus Q. See, the only difference between this and this is this little Q, which is the electric charge I put there. But if I multiply by this term, which is the extra term picked up by gauge symmetry, then these two terms will cancel. So it turns out the interaction term, if you just ask the nerve current interact with the vector potential, it's not a gauge invariant. And if you just look at the Dirac term, the kinetic term is not a gauge invariant. But at least they change in the same way, such that a linear combination of it is in gauge invariant. So I'll just add a minus Q, our interaction term. Oh, this thing is gauge invariant, so we can call it a fermion photon interaction theory. So that exactly is the QED Lagrange. Yep. Go ahead.
So we're allowing these local phase dependent symmetries, but they have to be coupled to the gauge symmetry of the electromagnetic field. That's what we're imposing here.
Yep.
Like we can do this shift of phase, like lower in each point in a mm-hmm. way, but we also have to put this into the AMU.
Exactly.
We cannot do one without the other.
No.
Okay. Yep. Question. It's just that normally if we have if we introduce the gauge, we normally upgrade the covariant derivative. So I don't understand why this is called the interaction term. Normally this also enters the free Lagrange.
If you just look at this term, it's not a free. It has one kind of particle, has another kind of particle.
I mean,
I know. Your point is very good. I'm coming to your covariant derivative right now. So you're basically telling me exactly what I should do the next time. So I'm going to do it right now about this covariant derivative thing. Okay. Yeah, of course. Yeah, we have done GR. We know exactly how to fix problem if there is a gauge symmetry. By then, it's called the diffeomorphism, called the general coordinate transformation, but nevertheless, they are gauge symmetry. And in GR, you fix the problem, says this derivative is not a good derivative. Let's fix it by upgrading into a covariant derivative. That's exactly what we're trying to do that here. You're saying this is not a good derivative provided we have a gauge symmetry, so we must upgrade it into a covariant derivative. And we're just going to now do make it sharpen this argument by doing mass algebra manipulation. So what we want is to make it look like, so I'm just gathering the term. What I'm doing now is called gathering these two terms together. I'm taking I gamma mu out. What's left is a partial nu, and the second term is that. So if you look at this, the first term I'm just copying down, and if you check this term, I and I, we can't give you a minus sign, q is there, a mu is there, partial is there. And the plus the mass term that is always there. And now is exactly what we do, is that we call this thing a covariant derivative. This is a definition. And then you are like, oh, happy. The only thing I need to do if I ever care to couple Dirac field to somebody else, it's actually very simple. I just take the partial derivative and turn it into a covariant derivative and what up.
I got lost because I thought that we were working in Minkowski space.
Yeah.
So why do we need a covariant derivative? You have curvature.
Yeah. But that's when you are interpreting GR. You are interpreting GR in the sense that, okay, we have a curved geometry, and then we have to come up with some covariant derivative to fix that. So such that the covariant derivative behaves like a partial derivative when you do calculations. But there is another interpretation. Another interpretation is that this literally any function of x. So this is a four vectors. So this is called the general coordinate transformation. That's the general coordinate transformation in GR. Says that it turns out, for example, Einstein-Hilbert action or Einstein equations, they are function of all these coordinates, but it's not, you have to remove something diffeomorphism, because let's say the Einstein's theory is invariant under general coordinate transformation. Right? So this is a statement that says this is the general coordinate system transformation. You can pick any function you want as long as it's zero. And then you have the statements that the Einstein series invariant under this. So this is actually, you can interpret it the same as Maxwell, is that you can interpret this as a gauge symmetry. Right? You change the thing into something else, depends on a bunch of, it's a local transformation, depends on the location. That's all we mean by local gauge symmetry. And then what Einstein theory does is that we will also need the covariant derivative to So that's where the covariant derivative comes from, is that we have a gauge symmetry, and then in order for partial derivative, the derivative makes sense with this symmetry. That's where the covariant derivative comes from. It's similar idea. You have a gauge theory, you have a partial derivative, you want to fix it so that you get some good derivative that respects this gauge symmetry. And in our case, again, we're defining a covariant derivative, and the only job is to make this partial derivative make sense, which means that it's gauge invariant. Yeah.
Why did we only worry about this, the lack of gauge symmetry when we were coupling it to a mu? Why were we fine with just having?
We are certainly worried because that Maxwell theory is a very well-tested theory. If our claim is we want to couple Dirac to Maxwell, since Maxwell is already gauge invariant. So you can't say we have a bunch of photons, they have gauge invariance, and now they couple to Fermi, then they are no longer gauge invariant. So that's why we do want to respect that, if we want to introduce interaction. If you want to say I have a vector field, it's not described by Maxwell theory, maybe you are able to write down something. For example, let's see. For example, I can write another interaction, Lagrange, and I have this one, and I say I can just write a copy of it. That's fine. And this one has no gauge symmetry, so you don't have to introduce anything. You don't have to promote your gauge symmetry, whatever. This guy cares nothing about this gauge symmetry at all. But if you couple to something does respect to gauge symmetry, then you should keep respecting. Okay, and this is known as the Fermi for Fermi theory. And it's a very useful theory to use at low energy. And if you take standard model and you will see where this comes from, to from like an even deeper theory in UV. But that's too much. Okay, so I just find, since we write down some bilinears, that we know these are good things, we can make theory out of them. We should make one, especially this one is gonna be our concentration of the last lecture. Well, last tutorial or whatever, last day. We're gonna spend a whole tutorial on trying to understand, where is my QED? Here, quantum electrodynamics. Yep, I was like, what? All right, that thing. Oh, of course, you can just write this. All right, so finally, we are going to move away from the classical field theory and quantize our Dirac fields. For completion, I'm sure that you have reviewed the of all fields. This is a very good recipe. It's interesting, Dan has a lot of good recipes, but he doesn't cook. he hands me this recipe, says, the first thing I want to do is write down a Lorentz invariant Lagrange. And the next thing I want to do is calculate the momentum, canonical whatever, this pi thing, and then I should calculate the Hamiltonian. And then the next step, I should impose some commutator relationship. It's just like in quantum mechanics, we suddenly decided that the position and the momentum doesn't commute anymore. And then the last step then there is some normal ordering so that we can sweep some infinities under the carpet. And hopefully you will uncover these infinities a little bit in QFT2. Right? It's on your quiz. And hopefully you have done it for scalar field. And we're just going to do it for Dirac field again. Yes?
I have some questions.
Yep.
So it seems to me that like by changing the phase of the wave function, it should be possible because like a wave function can have a complex phase at any point of like space and time. Just by doing that, this derivative picks up a factor.
No. Like you can't. Like the statement is psi as a wave function, you can pick up a phase. It never says that you can pick up a phase. That it depends on the space time. Like if you have a wave function, you can pick up a phase. But it's not like independent everywhere. Like that's exactly what we showed, is that you can't. If you give it an arbitrary phase that depends on space time, you will be picking up a new term. That's exactly what happened, is that you are not allowed to pick up an arbitrary phase unless you couple to some other theory which
is gauge invariant.
Pick up some phase. Okay, to be completion, I'm going to write on the Maxwell's Lagrangian 2. Otherwise, I can't quite call it the QED.
So does that mean that there is something special in this particular field?
In which sense?
In the sense that...
Well, of course, photon field is very special. It's not just a vector field that has four components, but we'll just have to wait a little bit on Thursday. On Thursday, when we quantize photon field, we can study deeper about all this specialness about the gauge invariant. Like, I can't talk about photon right now. It's a whole lecture, so. We'll just have to, if you have any curiosity, what is the gauge symmetry, and if it has a gauge symmetry, how could we do quantization? Well, just wait till next Thursday, when we have done with fermions. We're just having a flavor about how to couple fermions to other fields. And how to quantize those other fields, we'll get back to it. Okay, Dirac field. Step one. I guess I just really like this. So forget about the interconnection, we come back to the free Dirac field. That's step one, I pick a Lagrangian I'm happy with. Step two, I calculate this canonical momentum thing. Then I calculate something called a Hamiltonian. This is such a stretch of my memory. I'm going to take a look. But you just calculated, so you must know this perfectly well. There is a plus sign somewhere. Oh, for the mass, of course. All right. So that's from your homework, that you find such a Hamiltonian. And then the next thing I ask you to do, Hamiltonian density, the next thing I ask you to do in the homework, which I'll just write down the results, because you have done it. There's no point for me to do it on board again. Right? So this is just what you have seen in the homework. You arrive at a Hamiltonian of such kind. Okay, so we have a Hamiltonian, and then in the homework, I ask you to speculate, and then if you think something's problematic. I think I skimmed through them as fast as possible, but I think almost everybody says that this thing, there is a minus sign here, which is very suspicious. Minus sign. This is something different from, like, for example, complex scalar field. Okay. Well, nevertheless, we decide to close our eyes to ignore this problem. Well, it's not, it's just suspicious. It's not yelling at me, I'm a problem, solve me. No, didn't. Okay, close my eyes. Do exactly what you do in scalar field by promoting these things into operators. Okay. I was like, this is my Hamiltonian. I can do stuff. And then I realized, wait. I kind of like Hamiltonian of the form is Hamiltonian equals energy times how many particles are in this energy, and then I integrated over all possible momentum. That's how normally Hamiltonian look. But to see, this is very good. I decided to call it the B particle number density. Perfectly good name. The other one, see if it's a switch, would be nice. So of course, I'll try to switch it. So in this line, I'm gonna omitting all indices. I just don't want to carry all this SSPP around all the time. I'm just omitting for now. So what I want is to switch them, and what I learned in bosonic theory or any, and in elementary math is that I can always add a term and subtract it again. So that's a good way of manipulating things. So that's certainly true for any theory you want. You can always subtract and adding the same thing. And then I say, oh, I'm going to turn them into a commutator, which is nice because I think I'm going to impose some commutator relationship. And now they're swept. The leftover term has the thing swept. I'm happy. So I decide I'll plug this in back to the Hamiltonian. So this Hamiltonian, sorry for the abbreviation, I'm just going to drop the indices on B and C again. But if I plug that in, I get this term and this term. And I say, oh, good. I'm going to call this the C number particle. I was like, oh, I quantized the theory, I'm happy. And then you're like, wait a second. There is a thing about a Hamiltonian. It's also known as the energy. Okay, this minus sign is a problem, not just suspicious. It says, oh, look at me. If this is the end of the story, then we can just produce these C type of particles. And then the system's energies will keep dropping. So this is always very bad. Theory, energy should not be unbounded from below. You need to have somewhere where it's just like, this is the lowest energy, we're not going below that anymore. And of course, if you remember Dirac, he has all this theory that all those states are filled, and that's fine. But we're going to seek a quantum field theory explanation of this. So whenever you have a theory, you calculate the Hamiltonian and realize you can just do something such that it keep lowering the system's energy. That's never a good sign. Okay, we have a problem. And of course, to fix the problem is that I want this to be a plus. All I wanted is the same thing. I wanted my energy to be the individual particle contributing some energy times the number of particle and integrated. And I wanted some, but if you have two types of a particle, that's fine. But I still wanted my energy to be positive. So you, if you want that to be plus, so let's trace where that minus sign is.
Can't we use an anti-commutator there?
Yeah, very good. That's what I'm going to say in the next minute. That's very good. That's a very good idea, but let's trace it. So that minus sign comes out is because this guy, right? So if you want to flip that minus sign, I want to flip this to be a plus sign. And this sign is exactly the same as this sign. These two are the same sign. So if I, I want this to be minus. I want to flip it. So I wanted this sign to be minus. Okay, I'm just going to change it into minus. But except the math doesn't work out. So in addition to what I did, to change that to minus, I'd better change this into plus. And here comes our anti-commutator. So as exactly as you just said, if I only decided to impose the anti-commutator relationship instead of the commutator relationship, everything will be okay. Okay, I will be a good person and write down all the indices and all these factors once. So instead of imposing a commutator relationship, we actually want to impose an anti-commutator for the fermions. And the reason we want to do that is we do not want negative energy being produced when I make particles. If I put more particles in the system, it should always increase. It's like perpetual motion machine doesn't exist. That's why we need to do this. There might be other solution, but this is the solution presented by the quantum field theory canonical quantization, says instead of a commutator relationship, we should have imposed a anti-commutator relationship. That will solve this problem, flipping all the signs such that you end up with a plus sign over there. Okay, we should pause here a little bit and digest the importance of the anti-commutator relationship. Anti-commutator relationship is very important. As you have seen in your quiz, that if I have an anti-commutator relationship, what I ask you in the quiz is consider these particle number operator, and also consider the square of the number particle operator. And in the case of the anti-commutator relationship, you will realize a very interesting identity. It says n squared equals it. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could just elaborate more on like why the minus sign tells you that the energy is bounded from below.
And bounded. Sorry.
Bounded from below.
Okay, so let's throw away all these terms. And just looking at, we'll look at this guy. Just look at this piece and the last term. It says minus C dagger C. So if we just look at this term, and this is identified as a number operator. That means if I have more particles, I actually have lower energy. So then the system is very excited. It says, I'll just make more numbers and I keep going to lower energy. And that's not allowed as a physics system. So then we realize, oh, this minus sign caused all the problem. Let's try to put in the plus sign, and then you just keep backtracking where the sign comes from. You realize, oh, if I just abandon what scalar theory has taught me about this commutator relationship, instead embrace the new anti-commutator relationship, then the minus sign disappears. That's all good. Yep.
So in this case, this number operator is the one that creates particles, or is the C dagger the one that creates particles? Do we have like...
Excellent question. Excellent question. Let me emphasize, C dagger is still considered as a creation operator. And the C is still a annihilation operator. And we will write down the states. Like before, we have a vacuum. I can write now something very brief. Now it looks like this. So this part doesn't change the story. You still use the dagger to create some particle, and then use this C to annihilate some particle. The only thing we change is instead of the commutator relationship, we have an anti-commutator relationship. That's all need to be changed, but this changed a lot. So the idea is, in the quiz, we realize if you have an anti-commutator relationship, then the number of the particle actually is very, very limited. Because of this little algebra equation, you realize there can be zero particle or one particle, that's it. In other words, it says each available state, quantum state of the particle, can only have exactly one fermion in it. And that's where we pat our head and says, whoa. The difference is because now we are studying a fermion. So this is actually very phenomenal. Because when we write down the Dirac spinner field, we have some curious argument that says this is a spin half field. Because we did some 2 pi rotation, it come back to itself, pick up a minus sign. We're like, you must be a spin 1/2 field. So you start with a spin 1/2 field, and you write down some appropriate Lagrangian, decide let's quantize it, and then realize the consistency of Hamiltonian has to be bounded below, lead us to conclude that the spin 1/2 field is actually a fermion. So this is like a small demonstration of this spin statistic theorem. So we are led to a fermion. So this is very interesting, and I want to make a couple comments, which is, so we're done. We're basically done with step three. Step three is this thing is true, same as B. All the other anti-commutator vanish. It's exactly as you learn in the bosonic theory, except whenever you see a commutator, you turn into an anti-commutator. And then you can show that this particle creation annihilation operator satisfy anti-commutator relationship that is equivalent to imposing the anti-commutator relationship on your field and your momentum. Remember, this is a what we get from the quantum mechanics is you want to impose some relationship between x and p. You can still do the same. You can show that this is completely equivalent. You can assume the field momentum anti-commutator relationship and derive the ones for the creation and annihilation operators. Or you can do the other way. You can assume the creation of annihilation operator anti-commutator relationship, and then you can derive what happens between field, which is nice. It's consistent. You can impose whatever you want, and the other one will be automatically true. Okay. Let me be consistent and write this. Here. Take a field, you take a momentum, and then, yeah.
But okay, so to calculate this anti-commutator between the field and the momentum, we
use the
need to say that B is a fermion.
Yeah.
I mean, would be very strange, but from the energetic point of view, we have no reason. We just have to impose it on C, right? Are we imposing it on B for to say want to be the same type of particle as C, or could we say the particle is a boson and the antiparticle is a fermion?
Yeah, this is an excellent question. What's the relation between this B particle and the C particle? Why should I impose the same type of anti-commutator relationship? That's a very good question. I think one way to answer is that you can try to impose commutator for B, but then you would realize this is not equivalent. That's a mathematical answer. It says, for mathematically, if I want to get a field momentum operator relationship, like there's whole set, like the psi psi, okay. Let me just write. Psi psi should be zero, pi pi should be zero. So you have a whole set here. Then what I claim, I never checked, maybe I should have, this is the same thing, very important check, is that if I impose a different relationship for B, my claim is the set is not going to be true no matter what you choose, no matter you choose anti-commutator or commutator. And then my reason is that in Psi, B and the C are mixed up. Right? Psi is written as B times something plus C stars. So that would be my mathematical explanation. You just have to derive it and says, well, it seems we have forced them to be the same. Later today, maybe 10 minutes, maybe 20 minutes later, we will actually see some evidence that these B particles and the C particles actually relate in some way that you tend to believe that maybe we should impose the same kind of relationship. Yeah.
In the bosonic case, scalar case, we had
the normal word.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do in 1 minute.
Okay.
Oh, right now, actually, in 0 minutes. Normal ordering. So yes, exactly. That's the last step, right? Then we can have a break. So we're all very excited about the step. Remember this step two? Oh, actually right here, step three. I impose an anti-commutator relationship. Except it's nice for the fermion case. You really like step two and the three is tied together. You did a step two, and that tells us what kind of step three you can take. Okay, step four. Step four, and then we'll be done. So what normal ordering says is, I just want to order my commutators, operators in a way that my Hamiltonian look nice. By nice, I meant that it looks like a number operator. Also, the idea is that whatever you put here, anti-commutator, commutator, you're gonna have some infinity. So instead of actually using the anti-commutator relationship, we're just going to brute forcefully says you can swap to get rid of the infinity, which is not the best solution ever. But fun field theorists likes to do that. So what we do is to take the last term in your original Hamiltonian. So this guy. Okay, this is weird, but I think this little spot is better than a different board. I'll take this guy, and it says, I want this guy. That's all I want. No minus sign and a switch. So that's exactly how we're going to define the normal ordering. We define the normal ordering. Pardon my laziness, I'm dropping all these labels again. That's exactly what we want for normal ordering. So I can write it in a different way, move the minus signs to the other side. But the idea is for normal ordering in fermion case, I'll write the words over here. For normal ordering in fermion case, we want the same. We want annihilation operator to the right. Except swapping operators pick up a minus sign. And it's not completely crazy. You're using an anti-commutator relationship. Most of the time, the anti-commutator is zero anyway. So when you swap it, and of course you get a minus sign. You're assuming CC dagger plus C dagger C mostly, most of the time equals zero. So now you say, I just want to arbitrarily switching operators around. Of course, that's not okay. You'll get a minus sign. But otherwise, you still want to do the same. You want all the annihilation operator to the right and all the creation operator to the left.
Then why did we impose the other condition, the anti-commutator relationship, if we were to like normal order it later on?
Well, that's the reason you can do that, right? See, if you have anti-commutator, the A and B just some arbitrary things. Anti-commutator means most of the time this thing is true. And now you say, I want to swap them. It's only anti-commutator will allow you to get the minus sign. So this is a very it's a consistency. If you impose anti-commutator relationship, you'd better pick up a minus sign in the normal order. If you impose normal ordering has a minus sign, you'd better impose anti-commutator relationship. These are not unrelated things. Okay, I'll see one more sentence about this negative infinity that might be bugging us a little bit, and then we'll take a 5 minute break. So let's see, we see these as a problem, that scalar field has plus infinity energy, fermion field has minus infinity energy, what do we do them? But if you are innovative enough in the backs in the 1980s something. And you would say this is the opportunity to come up with the theory. It says, I will propose for each particle in our world, universe, and I will propose there is a particle almost exactly the same, except for the bosons, I propose there's a fermion. For the fermion, there is a boson. What that achieves to us, of course, is they contribute some amount of all this infinity energy. There's infinite zero-point energy, but they contribute exactly the same and with the opposite sign. So they will all cancel out. Isn't that nice? And this is, of course, the very well-known supersymmetry theory. that their idea of solving cosmological constant problem, which is interpreted sometimes as the vacuum energy of the quantum field theory, is that, well, they just all cancel out if all the bosons has a fermion partner and if all the fermions has a boson partner. Well, in some sense, well, of course, LHC has been looking for superparticles from the year it turns out, and they found that nothing whatsoever so far. But we still think supersymmetry is a very successful theory because we have already found half of the particles. Okay. I think we should regroup and learn something about this quantization of the Dirac field. What kind of question can we ask? Of course, the first question comes into mind is what you have already studied in scalar field. You can make states. You can start a vacuum, and then you demand all the initialization operator annihilated. And you can also demand a vacuum is nice, normalized. The cute question you can pops out from the fermion theory is, let's make a one particle state first. And then you can just call it, labeled it by its momentum vector and the spin label. And then the cool thing you can do is you say, I can try to create two particles. And then I decided to, this is completely individual's choice, is that you can write your two particle states like this. But once you pick the order of them, you should stick with it, because remember these things anti-commute now? So what I'm writing is I'm acting two creation operator acting on vacuum to get a two particle state. And now I say this is anti-commute, so I swap them. Which I pick up on minus sign. So this tells us if we have two particles, and if we just swap them, you'll pick up a minus sign. And this is what is known as the Fermi-Dirac statistics. So again, we see that after you agree that we need an anti-commutator relationship, then immediately we realize the thing we're dealing with is a fermion. And of course, another easy thing to do is just acting something twice, because this anti-commute with each other, so it's zero. That tells us the Pauli exclusion principle. You cannot put two particles in the same state. So again and again, we have been told that Dirac describes fermions, provided that we impose anti-commutator relationship on both B particle and C particle. So now is the question, is the time to ask, what is B and C? And why should they both use anti-commutators? B seems to be very well behaved in my Hamiltonian. to be able to answer this question, which is related to what we talked about at the beginning, is that in order to ask the question, what's the difference between B particle and the C particle? What's a B particle, C particle? I thought we were talking about the electrons, and now they just like B particle and C particle. To answer this, to be able to answer this question, I'll relate it to what we did in the beginning of the lecture, is we're going to couple it with the electromagnetic field and see what happens. What happens is, of course, we get this QED Lagrangian, and it doesn't take a lot of work to show that if you look at the QED Lagrangian, it's right here, and you calculate the Noether current of this Lagrangian, I mean, there's not really no difference. The only difference is that I add this little Q into the phase, says that's a identity of the particle. So, okay, let's first write the electromagnetic current is really given by this. Remember, this is the number of the particle, the conservation of the number of particle, the fermion number current. And then when you couple to electromagnetic field, it's probably not hard to convince you that the electric field, the four electric field, is just the charge of the individual particle times the number of them. So the next step, our favorite step, is of course take the zero component of this. Oh, this is already the zero component. Sorry. To integrate this thing, oh, it's already integrated. Never mind. Sorry. This is the total because that's the density and that's integrated over space-time. I'm saying that the total number of the charge to be coupled to the EM field is equals to the individual charge times the fermion number. And what this gave us, well, okay, some calculation needed, but now you are like experts on doing this calculation. It's like you see some field, you see some conjugated field. Okay, I know what the mode expansion of the field and conjugated field. I'll just plug it in and carry it out. So you are the expert of doing this, and I wouldn't embarrass myself to do this in front of you. So you will carry out these calculation and find the result is very interesting. The result is that it looks just like your Hamiltonian with a small caveat that this sign is flipped. So yeah, that's a much easier calculation than the one you did in homework. Takes about three or four lines. Because look at this term, it's way easier than the Hamiltonian. You don't have to use all this. The spinner identity is more like your canonical delta, and you don't have to use the spinner equation of motion. It's a much easier calculation. And what you arrive is this a sign. So now we're like, sure. But since we have a normal ordering proposed, let's normal order this guy. Nothing changed for the first term because it's already normal ordered. But this one in order for it to be normal order, it turns into a minus sign from normal ordering. Once we have a normal ordering prescription, now we have to follow it. It says, let me yet again call this B dagger B thing, call it the number of the B particle, number of the C particle. It says the total charge, total electromagnetic charge that the system contribute is equal to the all the charge contributed by the B particles subtract the charge, the charge contributed by the C particle if they have the same charge. But I can also interpret this differently, says that there is the B particle in contributed this way, and there is the C particle contribute negative charge. This is a completely equivalent statement. I'm just associating this minus sign to the charge instead. So this says, but this is a nicer it's nicer in English. It says the total charge is charge times number plus charge times number. With the caveat is that they carry exactly opposite of the charge. And of course, this calculation has nothing to do with it's a coupling to electromagnetic field. You can catch a coupling to the weak field, a coupling to whatever strong, whatever you can couple to. This is always true. This is a general demonstration of if you have a gauge theory and you will couple to Dirac fermion in the way that you upgrade your partial derivative into the correct covariant derivative. And then it immediately follows that your B particle and the C particle always carry this opposite charge. And they have the same mass. Then that's when we claim, make the claim, says C is B's antiparticle. And we predict the positron. I don't know, 30 years later than Dirac, using his C and the hole in the C theory. But here is the quantum field theory explanation is why C is called B's antiparticle, because they have the same mass, and for every charge B can possibly carry, C carry the opposite charge. So for the last 8 minutes, I would like, yet it's like going to a full circle now. Yep.
Is there any non-trivial commutation relation between the B's and the C's, or no?
No. Thank you for the question, but no.
So the only reason we call them the antiparticles is because of the charge?
Yep. Well, they have the same mass. For every possible charge you can think of, they carry opposite charge. They have the same spin, as I'll lay out a way to show. So the first order of using Lorentz group to characterize particles, as you can read up on chapter 2 of Weinberg, all you can read on the tutorial on Poincaré group on Wiki, is that the first level how you can distinguish particles is to look at their mass, because mass is Lorentz invariant. Then you look at the spin, which is also Lorentz invariant. Then there's the calculation to show, yes, it's a good label. If you have a spin half particle, there is no way you can boost your frame somehow, it turns into a spin one part. And then after that, if you are talking about a standard model, you probably have seen this standard model label, and then there's particle this, But if you are going to take a standard model with Latham Boyle, he is a fantastic lecturer, very clear. And he will tell you, what do you mean by a particle? A particle is, it has mass, it has a spin. Then the next thing is, how do we know it's this specific particle I'm talking about? Then it will give you the charge to couple to electromagnetic field. Then they will give you the charge, or how does it transform coupling to the weak field. Then it'll give you the strong charge, how to couple to the strong field to the gluons. Then that's it. That's all. It's like labeling particles. It's like labeling black hole. You only have that many labels. So a particle is associated with a bunch of labels. Once they are all labeled, so they are labeled by mass, spin, and then it's a bunch of charges under the very well-known, if you after standard model class, under this particular gauge group. This is the electromagnetic. Not really, but okay. This is way beyond what we learned, but you are going to associate some charge under this, some charge under that, and some charge under that. At this point, you can just understand that the particle is labeled by how much charge it carries when it interacts with each kind of gauge bosons, like photons, basically. There was photons and something, there were a bunch of other things that are more complicated than bosons. But that's it. Then all the particles is indistinguishable from each other. Yep.
That Q over there is the charge, right?
Huh?
That's Q.
Q total is how many charge altogether there is. This Q is like 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 coulomb for electron.
So how is that related to the?
It's Q, individual charge, times the number.
How is that related to Q1 or?
I'll answer that question when we study electromagnetic. This is not a question about it.
Is it because that B dagger B will?
It's basically you look at all the gauge transformation of the psi. That Q is the individual charge. So basically, if you study standard model. But yeah, this is really a standard model question. It's even like a deeper question than standard model, because standard model basically says we have a bunch of particles and they have some prescribed charge, and then you do some fancy symmetry broken thing, then you can calculate their electric charge. But actually all those charges you are assigned at the beginning is like ad hoc. It's like you assign a charge in a specific way such that the charge you get match with what you observe. So this is a very deep question. It's not a question I can answer because it's not answered yet. If I can, then I'll be really happy.
There is a prescription through
there?
Which one can compute the charges.
Yeah, it's in a simple answer, no. In the simple answer, no. You can't just derive out of your head why the particles we have the charge they have. And if you do have a simple prescription, then you're hitting the jackpot. That's like one of the best directions of beyond a standard model is try to explain why standard model works. What we have is a standard model of particle physics, and it works fantastically. It passed all sorts of experimental tests. We have no idea where it's from. You can say that it's just like somebody bump his head and says, oh, I'll write on this Lagrange. Well, the Lagrange is okay, but the charge, no. There is a direction called the unification theory. It's trying to say that this is not the fundamental thing. The fundamental thing is something simpler, which is just one, not a bunch of cross product. And in In that theory, yes, you can unify things and make things slightly simpler, except it doesn't work. In this theory, it's simpler. You don't have to prescribe, like, I don't know. Like in standard model, you have to prescribe like 5 different fermions and their charge. And there's no way you can relate to any of them, and they just happen to be the ones make experiment work. And in this theory, I think you only need to do 2 of them. You have 2 groups of fermions, and you declare they transform this way, carry this charge. And then you can have some broken symmetry, whatever. Then you will arrive at the standard model. Yes, it is simpler. There is just one caveat, it doesn't work. Because it predicts the proton can decay in some number of years, and that number of years is not bigger than the age of universe. Well, actually, and they have some, basically they predict the proton will decay in a way that you can design an experiment and put like a ton of, I don't know, water. And there is like lots and lots of experiment in the world is like that. You just find a gigantic tank of water and put it somewhere like bottom of the Arctic. So there's nothing, like there's no environmental disturbance. And you just watch them and they're waiting for a proton decay signal. And so far we haven't found any. So the result is negative. And it seems you have, because it's a really nice theory, so there's actually less freedom to tweak your things such that the proton decay slower. So yeah, but the question is very deep. There's no way I can answer that. And for me, I'm just being very ad hoc, says I pick the charge to be the charge of electron and stick there, and this describes how electron interact with photon. I pick the quark charge, and that tells me how quark interact with photon. I can't answer that, but yeah, it's a very good question. Okay, I'll take 1 more minute, because I think this thing is important. I'm not going to do the calculation. I'll just tell you the recipe, how to do it. So if you're interested, you should really take a look. There's the tutorial, there is a solution, so you don't really have to do calculation, but I really want to strike this point because I feel it's so cute. Remember the first day, I say, I want to know why Dirac is a spin 1/2 field. Then I say, I'll just rotate 2π and see what happens. But you find in the nature, all sorts of things can rotate. Like if you have a fan, then you kind of claim that the fan is like a spin 4 particle. That's just weird. So it's a very nice heuristic argument, but it's too heuristic. But you can be like, now that we finally have a 1 particle state, we can actually do it rigorously. So the proposal is, first, spin is related to rotation. So let's yet again consider a small rotation in XY plane. Sounds familiar, but the second part we're going to do things fancy. We'll find delta psi and then calculate the nether current. Oh, because that's, a Lorentz transformation, so it's definitely a symmetry, so it's conserved. And if you calculate this thing, of course you have a current. Then again, we do this. Then this thing, because we're rotating around a z, we'll call it the angular momentum in the z direction. And it turns out that this thing has 2 parts. One part is clearly x cross p. Like it just yielded in my face that it's all the orbital angular momentum. And the other one, of course, we can identify the spin. So what will you do? You say, let's go to rest frame and kill the angular momentum, orbital angular momentum. And now you have this spin part. So gz at the rest frame, now you grab one of this guy, which is called b guy, pr. and acting on vacuum. Better. And you ask, of course, is what is the eigenvalue? And if you compute it, you find it's 1/2. For r equals 0. And it's minus 1/2. R equals 1, sorry. 0 is not even available. And for r equals, yeah. So you actually showed if you have a one particle state and you measure the spin, you could realize one of the spin label solution corresponding to spin 1/2, the other one corresponding to spin 1 minus 1. So that's an electron spin up, spin down. And the C will describe the the positron spin up. So that will be a complete story of Dirac field, free Dirac field. And from Monday, we'll start to interact.